the plaintiff or the defendant or the defendant's attorney or whatever, and regardless of the merits of your case, there's no case for punitive damages. The money gets paid into the general fund. The reason for punitive damages, I can see that there's some merit to that. The reason for punitive damages is to prevent future harms to the public. This is the kind of irreprehensible conduct on the part of a defendant that you want to really teach them that stinging, biting lesson. And it's so as to protect the public, and so maybe it makes sense to pay in the general fund, but we're talking about private claims for punitive damages, and there aren't going to be private claims for punitive damages. There's a lot of work and time and effort involved if the money for those claims goes into a general fund, and so there's no lesson taught to the very wrongful defendant. And lastly, the point I was going to address is well, of course, the one that hits home for all attorneys is if there isn't a good, and that's a question of fact, I guess, claim for punitive damages where there wasn't sufficient knowledge of the facts, that the attorneys can be responsible as well as the parties and for the attorney fees. And that's a minor point, but our courts have said as a matter of public policy, they don't want to have attorneys spend a lot of time, they spend a lot of money in the cases, and don't want them to be personally responsible because of a close or a tough case.
Are there questions from the committee members? Certainly want to thank you for joining us this evening. I hope your children enjoyed this too.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see, we're going to temporarily close the hearing on this bill, and we're going to have a hearing on, or we have two bills on work session, which I don't think will take very long. Yes, Representative Bunn.
I would move House Bill 2769 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended.
Okay.
Well, the full committee will be as amended.
Representative Bunn moves House Bill 2769 to the full committee. With a due pass recommendation. However, there are some amendments.
I move the amendments also.
First, you move the amendments. Are there any objections to the amendments? Adopted. Now, we have Representative Bunn's motion on to move 2769 to full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Dunn?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
All right. This is
does that have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Yes. Yes, it does. I'm sorry. That's part of the motion as well, recommendation. And if it doesn't have a, it should. So. Now we have another bill for work session 2635. Representative Bunn. Is this the Bellamy motion?
Yes.
Let me, that's my name for that type of motion because it's an undebatable motion.
Yes, it is a Bellamy motion.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Does that mean I can't ask questions once that motion is made?
That's right.
Why you should
ask
them.
I better ask them now. I understand there's a move afoot to table this bill, and I don't have a lot tied up in it, but I would be interested in an explanation of why the committee is interested in that action.
Why a move from table?
Mm-hmm.
We have dealt in the last three sessions with the bills dealing with this sort of deal, and I guess there's always that case that can be brought up that a person comes in to testify in front of the legislature, and you talk about being, you know, they have to be liable for damages. Well, there are certain cases that it's probably okay, but then that just opens up the door for somebody to come in and claim legislative immunity and say whatever they want to, not legislative immunity, but say in front of the legislature some really, you know, bad things. And I guess I would say that certain congressmen use legislative immunity to infer a lot of things dealing with an outbreak of poisoning in the Dalles, and I guess I find things said in front of the legislature probably, in my opinion, should always be with caution. I guess it's a classic case in my mind, Representative Peterson, where you can abuse the privilege. We dealt with that with public state employees who came in and testified against their employer, and I believe that that bill passed.
Yes, where they cannot be, in terms of the employment situation, have recriminations brought to bear upon you for testifying before the legislature. I might add to what Representative Bellamy is saying is that I think it provides some caution to the general public to exercise some discretion in the words that they use before committee, as well as the topic matters. And I think also that there is, you know, my understanding, believe that there is a procedure where we can provide to the subpoena process to protect those from potential danger of slandering somebody or providing libelous situations. Where there is a need, we feel as a committee, to receive that information. And it's not a perfect system. I recognize that. I think, Mr. Barnard, from my knowledge of the situation, it's unfortunate that he had to defend that action brought to bear against him. But I don't think because of that one instance that we ought to change the entire procedure.
I guess that's the sort of information I was looking for, that there's not a rash of problems that this particular bill was attempting to address.
I guess one other thing, Representative, the longer you're around here, and not so much in this committee, but in other committees, you're going to get, every once in a while, hear some very irrational testimony that borders on being very slanderous. And if we, there's every once in a while an innocent victim, but if we open up the door, we are going to encourage people to come in here and say whatever they want and have no basis of fact, and sometimes can really cause irreparable harm if the press, for instance, picks it up. And I guess that's what I'm concerned about.
Thank you.
Representative Bunn?
Chairman, I move that House Bill 2635 be tabled.
The non-debatable motion. Clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Motion is adopted. We have House Bill 2958, and my understanding there's only one witness here, is that correct? Mr. Winkle. Okay. We have two witnesses signed up for 2805, I'll take that next, and then we have 2942. So those are the remaining three bills on the agenda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Morton Winkle. I practice law in Portland as a sole practitioner. I requested that this bill be drafted to solve a problem that arose in a case in my practice several years ago. Situation that's posited is a person who purchases a motor vehicle on a retail installment contract, and they are current in making their payments, and they have complied with the provisions of the contract to furnish insurance for the protection of the secured party. Many of these instruments have a provision that allows the secured party to nevertheless accelerate, declare a default, repossess the vehicle if the secured party feels that they are insecure. Presently, the Uniform Commercial Code in Chapter 71 provides that that may be done, and that if it is done and litigation ensues, it is the burden of the purchaser to establish that that was done in bad faith, synonymous to dishonesty. It seemed to me, and that provision was invoked in the Court of Appeals opinion in the case which I cite in my presentation, and it seemed to me that that is grossly unfair. Anybody that ever explained that to agreed with me, many people are astonished that that's the state of the law. And what this bill is designed to do is to allow defaults to be declared under those circumstances, but only if the buyer is engaging in conduct which might reasonably be deemed to impair the security. And if litigation ensues, it is the burden of the secured party to establish that they acted reasonably and that there were sufficient facts. Yes.
Do you have an example where this has been abused?
This case that's cited in the presentation. The opinion said that that's the law, and since there wasn't any evidence of bad faith in the conduct of the secured party, that they had a right to have a directed verdict in that case. Circumstances posited was that the payments were made. Now, that was a disputed issue of fact as to whether there was a waiver, but the court said even if the consumer prevailed on that issue, the secured party took the position that they had two justifications for repossessing. One, default. Second, feeling of insecurity. The only testimony about their feeling of insecurity was that there had been a lot of delinquencies in the past and that made them feel insecure. There wasn't any documentary evidence that the reason they repossessed was a feeling of insecurity. And that it was just a fallback position, in my opinion, obviously, as counsel. I would.
You want to change the law to do what?
To say that if a secured party wants to repossess in a situation where the payments are current, they have to have one of the statutory elements that either they're going to take the car out of the state, or that they're destroying the car, or that they're selling it without authorization, something which impairs the security. And if there is a dispute as to whether or not those facts existed, the burden of establishing that they existed is on the party invoking the remedy.
I guess I'd have to ask the question with Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I guess I'd have to ask the question, why would anybody ever want to repossess a vehicle? And I assume this applies to only vehicles, motor vehicles?
Yes.
Okay. Why would anybody want to repossess a vehicle when the payments were current?
Well, I'm not suggesting that that would be the case uniformly. And people that I've discussed this would say, oh, we would never do that. But it happened in this case. And it was the reason for an adverse result in that case, because they used this, in my opinion, as an excuse. It was their fallback position. Well, whether or not, let's not worry about whether the payments were current. In some cases, that's a jury question, whether they were current or not, whether there was a waiver, et cetera. In this case, it had to do with a day's difference as to whether it came into a lockbox on time. And the position of the defendant in the Court of Appeals was, says, well, let's assume that we're wrong on that issue. We had another independent ground for repossessing. We felt insecure. And once we say that, it's the consumer's burden to prove that we were dishonest in asserting that defense. That's the present state of the law. And it seems to me that that's very unfair to make that available.
Further questions? Mr. Winkle, if I could ask, just to clarify line 9. Destruction, I mean, you're talking about demolition or some sort of junking thereof.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Further questions?
Okay. Representative Peters.
It sounds like a good idea. I don't have a great deal of problem with it. I guess where some question enters my mind is, Do we make laws or change statute because there has been one problem? And maybe we do. I guess I'd just be interested in your response to that.
It doesn't seem unreasonable to me where you have a statute on the books which is very unfair. It might apply to somebody next week. In other words, that wasn't the law before the legislature made it. I'm now presenting the suggestion that the legislature made a mistake.
When was this law passed?
Uniform Commercial Code 1963, I guess.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Moving right along, House Bill 2805, Mr. Kenyon.
Thank you.
remarks rather short. I see everybody's going. But my name is Rob Kenyon. I'm with Telecheck of Oregon. The purpose of this legislation is to allow for the collection of a handling fee for dishonored checks when being collected by a third party. The banks are imposing ever-increasing charges for return dishonored checks to the depositor as well as to the person who wrote the bad check. Some banks are charging merchants as much as $5 currently, and in the eastern states, those charges are up as high as $10 to $15. Due to these fees being imposed without any means of recovery by a third party for the merchant depositor, the merchant is becoming more and more reluctant to accept checks as a form of payment for goods and services. Incidentally, checks are the method of payment most preferred by most customers. At present, third parties, such as check guarantee companies, of which I represent one, are governed by Federal Law 95-109, which became effective September 20th, 1977. The pertinent section of this law says that the following conduct is a violation, Section 8, or Section 808, number 1. Collection of any amount, including any interest, fee, charge, or expense incidental to the principal obligation, unless such amount is expressly authorized by the agreement creating the debt or permitted by law. This subsection allows a collector to impose, or a third party to impose, an interest charge, fee, or some other charge or expense to the account being collected if the state law or the agreement creating the debt allows this. We are well aware of Oregon law, Senate Bill 918, relating to what is commonly called the triple damage law. However, the law is usable only when an action is filed. It does not address the problem of the restraint placed on the business due to the fee imposed on the merchant for the return check. The purpose the proposed legislation would allow for recovery of the merchant's out-of-pocket expense. Checks are the preferred payment method in the United States. Over 96% of the buying public has one or more checking accounts, whereas less than 50% of consumers have credit cards. It seems in these competitive economic times, the businessman needs to encourage the customer to make his purchase at his business regardless of what method of payment the consumer desires. I don't need to tell you, any of you, the inconvenience and danger of carrying large sums of money. We urge the committee to provide our business community with every means to assure their financial well-being by allowing every merchant to accept checks with the reasonable assurance that he can recover his costs if the check is dishonored. You can create this positive business climate by giving your vote of approval for this House bill. Questions? Council.
Yeah, Mr. Kenyon,
yeah.
This bill allows fees to be collected, and I'm going to relay a story to you, and I beg your indulgence. A person I know wrote a check for $2.50, and she did not have enough money in the bank, and the check bounced, and she later on deposited the check, and she was called by a collection agency saying, you have an insufficient check. We want the $2.50, which you owe us, plus a $35 collection fee. She happens to be an attorney, and she says, I'll call you back later. What I'm worried about in this bill is the collection fee, how much it can be. You say reasonable, but who determines reasonable?
Well, that can be determined in a couple of different ways. Number one is, which I don't necessarily want to do, but an amendment could be made to the point that the collection fee could be, as an example, no greater than the face value of the check. And so that on your $2.50 example, it couldn't be any larger than $2.50. Or it could be a situation of setting a figure of, let's say, $40 or the face value of the check, whichever is lesser. if it is necessary to establish a dollar figure. I guess one of the concerns that I would have with setting a figure is that what happens in 10 years or 5 years with inflation and other things, and you set a figure of, say, $5 or $10 or $15 today, that the banks increase their fees to $25 or $30 to that merchant for a returned item, then what fee is reasonable at that time? Obviously, where banks are currently charging $5 to $10, a $10 fee to cover his fee to cover the bank's charge would be adequate. But if the fee were increased to $15 or $20, then that set fee of $5 or $10 would not cover it.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Kenny, what kind of a business do you own?
We guarantee checks for merchants. What we do is at the time the merchant takes the check, we work very similar to what Visa and MasterCard do for credit cards, only we do it for personal and company checks. A merchant will call us. If we verify and approve that check, then we will in effect guarantee the check, face value of the check. The problem that is coming in is with the increasing fees that are being charged by the bank to the merchant, is that he is becoming more and more reluctant to want to take checks as a form of payment, because maybe he takes, as an example, a $2.50 check. The bank charges $5 for him. He's not too excited about the fact that he took the $2.50 check.
If I may comment, Mr. Chair, I'm a businesswoman. I own a retail business in Ashland, and we occasionally get checks where people are overdrawn. They're often from good customers, and I would assume in this kind of bill, you could choose to ask for that money, or
that is,
you could not.
That is
that
correct.
Correct.
That is correct.
In the businesses you deal with primarily, do you run into this? Is it a very common problem? Because in my business, it's not that common.
Okay.
So I'm
5 years ago, it was not a common problem because the amount the banks were charging was anywhere from 25 cents to 75 cents for a returned item to a merchant. Provided he kept a credit balance in that bank, he rarely ever saw the fact that he was getting charged. In today's business climate, with the banks having increased their charges to what they are now, some as high as I indicated, $5, and in the East they're much, much higher now, and we tend to be a little bit behind the East when it comes to some banking trends. And yes, it is becoming more and more of a problem. I talked to one of our merchants just yesterday, and he had a returned item come back from the bank with $5 on it. He had accepted another check from that individual. The account's closed. But for him to get any restitution whatsoever, and the check had to be for $4, he had to run it back through the bank. He had to run the next check through the bank so that it would come back dishonored also for him to be able to get any restitution. He's going to get charged, he knows, another $5, and he may not ever get a collection on the second bad debt.
Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, I am a bit confused. I see these signs on every cash register in the state saying if you give us a bad check, we're going to get triple the damages or $100. Now, doesn't a merchant or a lender have the right to go, say, to small claims court and collect these dishonor checks inexpensively?
He has that avenue open to him, but let me, he's got a file for to go to court and file for. It's going to cost him between $15 and $75 to do that. He's got a $5 to $10 to $15, $20 check. Is it worth $50 more or $75 more to throw after that $20 check that he's already assumed and owns, basically? Is it right to throw that much more money after it with the possibility of being able to get triple damages?
Counsel.
Would the merchant then turn over to a collection agency and say, we'll take half the money? Is that the
In many cases, that's what does happen.
Mr. Kinney, one last thing. Is your check guarantor or guarantor, I don't know the proper word is, may I be so blunt to ask what your fee is, or you have a fee per check or a standard fee? Or
okay. What our service cost the merchant, that's basically what you're asking. is a fee that is charged on the volume of checks that they call us on, and it ranges anywhere from about a half a percent to somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.5-4%, the average being someplace in the neighborhood of 2%, very similar to what Visa and MasterCard is charging. And it's based on the volume of checks that they verify and have guaranteed.
Thank you, and I do have a Representative Hooley's testimony in support of this measure. She had a meeting in her district tonight, couldn't make it, but she did ask that we have this statement be made a part of the record. Do you have a copy as well, Council?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, do you have a copy of this letter and booklet from Jack Barnes from Farmers Insurance?
No, I don't.
It's sent to all the members, and we can make maybe.
Is that up for the record as well?
That's another bill, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, we just, one of the things we don't feel that the previous Oregon law, which is basically known as triple damages, really addresses the situation that's here currently. And that's the reason for the introduction of this bill.
Okay. Thank you, and we do appreciate your coming down this evening. Be sure to drive carefully. Mr. Hammack was here. Is he going to be
good?
Are there any other individuals who wanted to testify on this bill? Okay, if not, we'll close the hearing on this bill. And we are down to House Bill 2942. Mr. Barnes, Mr. Bauer, did you want to join hands and come up here together? Appreciate your indulgence today. I'm sure you learned a lot. The other bills that are in this legislature?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Barnes and I represent Farmers Insurance Company of Oregon. I have with me tonight Keith Bauer of defense firm of Parson Bauer, who would like to speak in support of House Bill 2942. Before Mr. Bauer speaks, I would like to make some remarks regarding the background of our support for this House bill. House Bill 2942 is a joint industry resolution on punitive damages. Signatories of the resolution are the Alliance of American Insurers, the American Insurance Association, the American Council of Life Insurance, the Health Insurance Association of America, National Association of Independent Insurers, Farmers Insurance Group, and State Farm Insurance Company. The impetus behind House Bill 2942 stems from our following concerns: that punitive damage awards have grown in recent years to the point where society can no longer afford to ignore their adverse impact on the civil litigation process, that the purpose of the law of civil remedies is to compensate individuals injured by the wrongful conduct of others and not to punish or deter wrongful conduct, that the law of compensatory damages is adequate to ensure that the injured plaintiff is made whole, that the most appropriate process for deciding what social conduct is punishable and who should be punished is the criminal justice system and not the civil justice system, and that the success of a few plaintiffs in obtaining large punitive damage awards has led to widespread allegations of punitive damages in non-meritorious cases. The insurance industry has a responsibility to seek improvements to the efficiency, fairness, and cost of the civil litigation process on behalf of its policyholders and the general public. Consistent with this responsibility, several model laws have been developed and advocated by the insurance industry sponsors as a means to reduce the adverse effects of excessive punitive damage awards. Mr. Bauer can testify to the specifics of the bill which address these issues.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Best game members of the committee. I have before you a general commentary and review of the bill, and with the late hour, I'm not going to bore you with walking through each step of it, but I would like to address the issue of punitive damages in Oregon. Strago, I've known for a long time, school and way back. I respect his comments, but by the same token, I think it has to be put in the proper perspective. We are not dealing with compensatory damages. We are not dealing with an injured person and whether or not that person can be made whole by damages that are awarded to the person for the pain and suffering, for the lost wages, for the medical expenses, or anything of that nature. What we're talking about in punitive damages is that damage that will punish the defendant and make him realize what he is, he or she or the corporation, whoever the defendant is done wrong. that's why, I think under the current state of the Oregon law, punitive damages are very broad, and what the court has had a real hard time in trying to set some type of standard for punitive damages. We've dealt with gross misconduct, we've dealt with willful and wanton conduct, we've dealt with intentional conduct. The court's played and tried to work around with different definitions of those, and they've had a real hard time trying to establish what should be the standard for punitive damages. Punitive damages originally were damages that were, by their name, to punish a party. They're in the nature of a civil remedy comparable to a criminal matter. If a person is charged with a crime, charged with wrongdoing, charged with some kind of intentional act, in doing that then, the court said that you have certain safeguards. You've got double jeopardy standards, you've got proof beyond a reasonable doubt, you've got a unanimous jury, you've got the issues that are basically held within a criminal case because you're dealing with something more than just compensating an injured party. You're dealing with true punishment to the individual, punishment by money damages in the nature of a fine in a criminal case. It many times was drawn to in the development of the case law. Well, for some reason, there's been a drawing away from that, and I think it's